Lunch. The two of them would eat in her room. Sometimes he heard the sounds of their talking as they ate, or their spoons tapping against soup bowls, or the nocturnes of Chopin. They were silent lovers, mercifully so, compared with other couples he'd overheard in the house through the years. But their presence soon prompted him to go to the library on Mondays, for he was affected nevertheless, embarrassed by the time her door had been partly open and he'd seen Farouk zipping his jeans. 3 years had passed since Teresa, the one girlfriend he'd ever had. He'd dated no one since. Because of Teresa, he'd chosen a graduate school in Boston. For a few months, he had lived with her in her apartment on St. Botolph Street. For Thanksgiving, he'd gone with her to her parents' house in Deerfield. It was there that it had ended. "I'm sorry, Paul. I can't help it. I just don't like the way you kiss me," she told him, once they'd gone to bed. He remembered himself sitting naked on one side of the mattress in a room he was suddenly aware he was never again to see. He had not argued in the wake of his shame. He became strangely efficient and agreeable with her, with everyone. Late one night, Paul was in bed reading when he heard a car pull up to the house. The clock on his desk said 2:20. He shut off his lamp and got up to look through the window. It was November. A full moon illuminated the wide, desolate street, lined with trash bags and recycling bins. There was a taxi in front of the house, the engine still running. Sang emerged from it alone. For close to a minute, she stood there on the sidewalk. He waited by the window until she climbed up to the porch, then listened as she climbed the staircase and shut the door to her room. Farouk had picked her up that afternoon. Paul had seen her stepping into his car. He thought perhaps they'd fought, though the next day he detected no signs of discord. He overheard her speaking to Farouk on the phone in good spirits, deciding on a video to rent. But that night, around the same time, the same thing happened. The third night, he stayed awake on purpose, making sure she got in. The following morning, a Sunday, Paul, Heather, and Sang had pancakes together in the kitchen. Sang was playing Louis Armstrong on the CD player in her room while Paul fried the pancakes in 2 cast-iron skillets. "Kevin's sleeping over tonight," Heather said. She'd met him recently. He was a physicist at MIT. "I hope that's okay."
"Sure thing," Paul said. He liked Kevin. He had been coming over often for dinner and brought beers and helped with the dishes afterward, talking to Paul as much as he talked to Heather.
"I'm sorry I keep missing him. He seems really nice," Sang said.
"We'll see," Heather said. "Next week is our 1 month anniversary." Sang smiled, as if this modest commemoration were in fact something of much greater significance.
"Congratulations."
Heather crossed her fingers. "I guess the next stage is when you assume you're going to spend weekends together." Paul glanced at Sang, who said nothing. She got up, returning 5 minutes later from the cellar with a basket full of laundry.
"Nice jockeys,"
Heather said, noticing several pairs folded on top of the pile.
"They're Farouk's,"
Sang said.
"He doesn't have a washing machine?"
Heather wanted to know.
"He does,"
Sang said, oblivious of Heather's disapproving expression.
"But it's coin-operated."
The argument started around Thanksgiving. Paul would hear Sang crying into the phone in her room, the gray plastic cord stretched across the linoleum and then across the landing, disappearing under her door. One of the fights had something to do with a party Sang had been invited to, which Farouk didn't want to attend. Another was about Farouk's birthday. Sang had spent the day before making a cake. The house smelled of oranges and almonds, and Paul heard the electric beater going late at night. But the next afternoon, he saw the cake in the trash can. Once returning from school, he discovered that Farouk was there, the BMW parked outside. It was a painfully cold December day. Early that morning, the season's first flakes had fallen. Walking past Sang's room, Paul heard her raised voice. She was accusing.
Why didn't he ever want to meet her friends? Why didn't he invite her to his cousin's house for Thanksgiving? Why didn't he like to spend the night together? Why, at the very least, didn't he drive her home?
"I pay for the cabs," Farouk said quietly. "What difference does it make?"
"I hate it, Farouk. It's abnormal."
"You know I don't sleep well when you're there."
"How are we ever going to get married?" she demanded. "Are we supposed to live in separate houses forever?"
"Sang, please," Farouk said. "Try to be calm. Your roommates will hear."
Will you stop about my roommates?
Sang shouted.
You're hysterical, Farouk said.
She began to cry.
I've warned you, Sang, Farouk said. He sounded desperate. I will not spend my life with a woman who makes scenes.
Fuck you.
Something, a plate or a glass, struck the wall and broke. Then the room went quiet. After much deliberation, Paul knocked softly. No one replied. A few hours later, Paul nearly bumped into Sang as she was emerging from her bathroom, wrapped in a large dark pink towel. Her wet hair was uncombed and tangled, a knot bulging like a small nest on one side of her head. For weeks he had longed to catch a glimpse of her this way, and still he felt wholly unprepared for the vision of her bare legs and arms, her damp face and shoulders.
Hey,
he said, sidling quickly past.
Paul,
she called out after a moment, as if his presence had registered only then. He turned to look at her. Though it was barely past four, the sun was already setting in the living room window, casting a golden patch of light to one side of her in the hallway.
What's up?
He said. She crossed her arms in front of her, a hand concealing each shoulder. A spot on her forehead was coated with what appeared to be toothpaste.
I'm sorry about earlier.
That's okay.
It's not. You have an exam to study for.
Her eyes were shining brightly, and she had a funny frozen smile on her face, her lips slightly parted. He began to smile back when he saw she was about to cry. He nodded.
It doesn't matter.
For a week, Farouk didn't call, though when the phone rang, she flew to answer it. She was home every night for dinner. She had long conversations with her sister in London.
Tell me if you think this is normal,
Paul overheard her say as he walked into the kitchen.
We're driving one time, and he told me I smelled bad, sweaty. He told me to wash under my arms. He kept saying it wasn't a criticism, that people in love should be able to say things like that to each other.
One day, Charles took Sang out, and in the evening she returned with shopping bags from the outlets in Kittery. Another night, she accepted an invitation to see a movie at the Coolidge with Paul, Heather, and Kevin, but once they'd reached the box office, she told them she had a headache and walked back to the house.
I bet you they've split up,
Heather said once they settled into their seats. But the following week, Farouk called when Sang was at work. Though Farouk hadn't bothered to identify himself, Paul called the bookstore, leaving her the message. The relationship resumed its course, but Paul noticed that Farouk no longer set foot in the house. He wouldn't even ring the bell. He would pause at the curb, the engine of his car still running, beeping three times to signal that he was waiting for her, and then she would disappear. Over winter break, she went away to London. Her sister had a baby boy recently. Sang showed Paul the things she bought for the baby: play suits full of snaps, a stuffed octopus, a miniature French sailor's shirt, a mobile of stars and planets that glowed in the dark.
I'm going to be called Sang Mashi, she told him excitedly,
explaining that Mashi was the Bengali word for aunt. The word sounded strange on her lips. She spoke Bengali infrequently, never to her sister, never to her suitors, only a word here and there to her parents in Michigan, to whom she spoke on weekends.
How do you say bon voyage? Paul asked.
She told him she wasn't sure. Without her there, it was easier for Paul to study, his mind spacious and clear. His exam was less than 6 months away. A date and time had been scheduled, the first Tuesday in May, at 10 o'clock, marked with an X on the calendar over his desk. Since summer, he had worked his way, yet again, through the list of poems and critical essays and plays, typing summaries of them into his computer. He had printed out these summaries, three-hole-punched them, put them in a series of binders. He wrote further summaries of the summaries on index cards that he reviewed before bed, filed in shoeboxes. For Christmas, he was invited to an aunt's house in Buffalo as usual. This year, with his exam as an excuse, he declined the invitation, mailing off gifts. Heather was away too. She and Kevin had gone skiing in Vermont. To mark the new year, Paul set up a new routine, spreading himself all over the house. In the mornings, he reviewed poetry at the kitchen table. After lunch, criticism in the living room. A Shakespeare play before bed. He began to leave his things, his binders and his shoeboxes and his books on the kitchen table, on certain steps of the staircase, on the coffee table in the living room.
He was slouched in the Papasan chair one snowy afternoon, reading his notes on Aristotle's Poetics, when the doorbell rang. It was a UPS man with a package for Sang, something from J. Crew. Paul signed for it and took it upstairs. He leaned it against the door of her room, which caused the door to open slightly. He closed it firmly, and for a moment he stood there, his hands still on the knob. Even though she was in London, he knocked before entering. The futon was neatly made, a red batik bedspread covering the top. The green walls were bare, but for two framed Indian miniatures of palace scenes, men smoking hookahs and reclining on cushions, bare-bellied women dancing in a ring. There was none of the disarray he for some reason pictured every time he walked by her room. Only outside, through the windows, was there the silent chaos of the storm. The snow fell in disorderly swirls, yet it covered the brown porch railing below neatly, as if it were a painted trim. A single panel of a white seersucker curtain was loosely cinched with a peach silk scarf that Sang sometimes knotted at her throat, causing the fabric of the curtain to gather in the shape of a slim hourglass. Paul untied the scarf, letting the curtain cover the window pane. Without touching his face to the scarf, he smelled the perfume that lingered in its weave. He went to the futon and sat down, his legs extending along the oatmeal carpet. He took off his shoes and socks. On a wine crate next to the futon was a glass of water that had gathered bubbles, a small pot of Vaseline. He undid his belt buckle, but suddenly the desire left him, absent from his body just as she was absent from the room. He buckled his belt again, and then slowly he lifted the bedspread. The sheets were flannel, blue and white, a pattern of fleur-de-lis. He had drifted off to sleep when he heard the phone ring. He stumbled barefoot out of Sang's room into the kitchen, the linoleum chilly.
Hello?
No one replied on the other end, and he was about to hang up when he heard a dog barking.
Hello?
He repeated. It occurred to him it might be Sang, a poor connection from London.
Sang, is that you?
The caller hung up. That evening, after dinner, the phone rang again. When he picked it up, he heard the same dog he'd heard earlier.
Balthasar, shush!
A woman said as soon as Paul said hello. Her voice was hesitant. Was Sang in? She wanted to know.
She's not here. May I take a message?
She left her name, Deirdre Frayne, and a telephone number. Paul wrote it down on the message pad under Partha Mazumdar, a suitor who'd called from Cleveland in the morning. The next day, Deirdre called again. Again, Paul told her Sang wasn't there, adding that she wouldn't be back until the weekend. Where is she? Deirdre asked.
She's out of the country.
In Cairo?
This took him by surprise. No, London.
In London, she repeated. She sounded relieved. London. Okay, thanks. The fourth call was very late at night, when Paul was already in bed. He went downstairs, feeling for the phone in the dark. It's Deirdre. She sounded slightly out of breath, as if it were she, not he, who'd just rushed to the phone. He flicked on the light switch, rubbing his eyes behind his glasses.
As I said, Sang's not back yet.
I don't want to talk to Sang.
She was slurring her words, exaggerating the pronunciation of Sang's name in a slightly cruel way. Paul heard music, a trumpet crooning softly.
You don't?
No, she said. Actually, I have a question.
A question?
Yes. There was a pause, the clink of an ice cube falling into a glass. Her tone had become flirtatious. So, what's your name? He took off his glasses, allowing the room to go blurry. He couldn't recall the last time a woman had spoken to him that way.
Paul?
Paul, she repeated. Can I ask you another question, Paul?
What?
It's about Sang. He stiffened. Again she had said the name without kindness.
What about Sang?
Deirdre paused. She's your housemate, right?
That's right.
Well, I was wondering then, if you'd know, if... Are they cousins?
Who?
Sang and Freddy. He put his glasses on again, drawing things into focus. He was unnerved by this woman's curiosity. It wasn't her business, he wanted to tell her. But before he could do that, Deirdre began quietly crying.
He looked at the clock on the stove. It was close to 3 in the morning. It was his own fault. He shouldn't have answered the phone so late. He wished he hadn't told the woman his name.
"Deirdre," he said after a while, tired of listening to her, "are you still there?"
She stopped crying. Her breathing was uneven, penetrating his ear.
"I don't know who you are," Paul said. "I don't understand why you're calling me."
"I love him."
He hung up, his heart hammering. He had the urge to take a shower. He wanted to erase her name from the legal pad. He stared at the receiver, remnants of Sang's mole-colored fingerprints still visible here and there. For the first time since the winter break had begun, he felt lonely in the house. The call had to be a fluke. Some other Sang the woman was referring to. Maybe it was a scheme on behalf of one of her Indian suitors to cast suspicion, to woo her away from Farouk. Before Sang left for London, the fights had subsided, and things between Sang and Farouk, as far as Paul could tell, were still the same. In the living room, she'd been wrapping a brown leather satchel, a pair of men's driving gloves. The night before she left, she made a dinner reservation for the two of them at Biba. Farouk had driven her to the airport. The ringing of the phone woke Paul the next morning. He remained in bed, listening to it, looking at the ashen branches of the tree outside his window. He counted 12 rings before they stopped. The phone rang half an hour later, and he ignored it again. The third time, he was in the kitchen. When it stopped, he unplugged the cord from the jack. Though he studied in silence for the remainder of the day, he felt fitful. Sitting in the kitchen that evening with a brick-like volume of Spencer, he was unable to concentrate on the lines, irritated by the footnotes, by how much there was left to learn. He wondered how many times Deirdre had tried to call him since he'd unplugged the phone. Had she given up? The calling seemed obsessive to him. He wondered whether she was the type to do something, to take a bottle of pills. After dinner, he plugged the phone back into the jack. There were no further calls. And yet his mind continued to wander. Something told him that she'd try again. He'd made the mistake of telling her when Sang would be back. Perhaps Deirdre was waiting to speak to her directly. Perhaps Deirdre would tell Sang the same thing she'd told him about loving Farouk. Before going to bed, he poured himself a glass of Dewar's, a gift sent by his aunt in Buffalo. Then he dialed the number Deirdre had given him. She picked up right away with a lilting hello.
"Deirdre, it's Paul."
"Paul," she said slowly.
You called me last night. I'm Sang's housemate."
"Of course, Paul. You hung up on me, Paul."
She appeared to be drunk again, but in a sunnier mood.
"Listen, I'm sorry about that. I just wanted to make sure you were okay."
Deirdre sighed. "That's sweet of you, Paul."
"And to ask you to please stop calling me?"
he said after a considerable pause.
"Why?"
There was panic in her voice.
"Because I don't know you," he said.
"Would you like to know me, Paul?" she said. "I'm a very likable person."
"I have to go," he said firmly, hoping not to provoke her. "But maybe there's someone else you could talk to. A friend?"
"Freddy's my friend."
The mention of Farouk, the use of the nickname, unsettled Paul as it had the night before. Yesterday, he'd surmised that Deirdre might be a student of Farouk's at Harvard, practically a teenager infatuated with an older man. He imagined her sitting at the back of a lecture hall, visiting him in his office, getting the wrong idea. Now a simple, reasonable question, which was at the same time a poisoned question, formed in Paul's mind.
"So how exactly do you know Farouk?"
Paul asked lightly, as if they were chatting at a party.
He didn't think she'd tell him, thought she might even hang up on him as he had on her, but they slipped easily into a conversation. It was Deirdre who did most of the talking. She told Paul that she was from Vancouver originally, and that she'd moved to Boston in her 20s to study interior design. She'd met Farouk one Sunday afternoon 1.5 years ago, when she was walking out of a cafe in the South End. He had followed her halfway down the block, tapped her on the shoulder, looked her up and down with unconcealed desire.
"You can't imagine," Deirdre said, remembering it. "You can't imagine how something like that feels."
Nevertheless, he'd been gentlemanly. For their first date, they'd gone to Walden Pond. Afterward, they bought corn and tomatoes and grilled salmon in her backyard. Farouk loved her home, an old farmhouse on 5 acres. He asked her to draw up the plans for redoing his kitchen. On Labor Day, they had hiked Mount Sunapee together. She had said other things Paul listened to, unsure of how much he should believe. For either they were true and Farouk and Deirdre were having a full-blown affair, or Deirdre was simply inventing it all, the way lonely drunk people sometimes invent things. At one point, he wandered into the hallway and opened Sang's door, making sure the curtain was tied as he'd remembered it.
"What about you?" Deirdre asked suddenly.
"What about me?"
"Well, here I am going on and you haven't said a thing. What do you like, Paul? Are you happy?"
He had sacrificed an hour to this woman. The edge of his ear ached from pressing the phone to it for so long.
"This isn't about me," he swallowed, shutting the door to Sang's room. "It's about Sang."
"They're cousins, right?"
Deirdre said. He could barely hear her.
"Aren't they?"
The desperation with which she asked him brought with it a crushing certainty. He knew that all she had told him was true, the knowledge of something having gone terribly wrong leveling him the way his exam had, the way Teresa's words had.
"Sang and Farouk are not cousins," he said.
He felt a strange inward power as he spoke, aware that the information could devastate her. She was silent.
"They're boyfriend and girlfriend, Deirdre," he said. "A serious couple."
"Oh, yeah?"
Her tone was challenging.
"How serious?"
He thought for a moment.
"They see each other 4 or 5 nights a week."
"They do?"
To Paul's satisfaction, Deirdre sounded wounded by this information.
"Yes," he said, adding, "They've been together for over 3 years.
3?
The word trailed off weakly in a way that made Paul wonder if she might cry again. But when she spoke next, her voice was clear.
"Well, we're a serious couple too. I picked him up from the airport yesterday when he came back from Cairo. I saw him tonight. He was here for dinner, here in my house. He made love to me on my staircase, Paul. An hour ago, I could still feel him dripping down my thighs."
Sang returned from London with presents for the house. Kit Kats in red wrappers, tea from Harrods, marmalade, chocolate-coated biscuits. A snapshot of her nephew went up on the refrigerator, his small, smiling face pressed against Sang's. Paul from his room saw that it was Farouk who dropped her off at the house. Eventually, Paul had gone downstairs, down the magnificent staircase, which he was now unable to descend without a fleeting image of Farouk naked on top of a woman who was not Sang. In the kitchen, he opened his cupboard and pulled down the Dewars.
"Wow, things have really changed around here," Sang said, smiling, her eyebrows raised in amusement watching him pour the drink.
"What do you mean?"
"You're drinking scotch. If I'd known, I would have bought you some single malt and duty-free instead of the Kit Kats."
The thought of her buying him a gift depressed him. They were friendly, but they were not friends. He offered her a glass of the scotch, which she accepted. They sat together at the table. She clinked her glass against his. She began sorting through the mail Paul had collected for her. Her hair was a few inches shorter. She smelled intensely of a spicy perfume.
"I don't know any Deirdres," she said, reading her messages on the legal pad. "Did she say why she was calling?"
He drained his glass and was already pacified by the drink. He shook his head.
"I wonder what I should do."
"About what?"
"Well, should I call her back?"
He stood up and opened the freezer to get ice cubes for a second drink. When he returned to the table, she was crossing out the name with a pencil.
"Forget it. She's probably a telemarketer or something."
Avoiding Sang was easy. The university library, which Paul normally found so charmless with its cement floors and gray metal shelves and carols full of anonymous ballpoint philosophy, was where he began to spend his days. At home, he discovered that it was just as easy to take a sandwich up to his room. Winter gave way to a wet, reluctant spring full of wind and slanted rains that lashed the window by Paul's bed. Whenever the phone rang, he didn't answer. In the first few days after Sang's return, he was convinced each time that it would be Deirdre demanding to talk to Sang. But Deirdre never called. He waited for her voice, the things she had told him, to fade from his memory. But but the conversations had lodged themselves stubbornly in his mind, alongside all the plays and poems and essays. He saw two people swimming in Walden Pond, their heads above the surface of the water. But then there was Sang, day after day, disappearing to eat dinner at Farouk's. There she was, sitting at the kitchen table, booking Farouk's tickets to Cairo for the summer, his credit card number written on a sheet of paper. After 2 months, Deirdre still hadn't called, and Paul finally stopped fearing that she would. Paul took the week of his spring break off from studying.
"Stop cramming. That's probably what happened the first time. Go to the Caribbean," his advisor suggested.
Instead, Paul stayed at home, but declared himself officially on vacation. He went to movies at the Brattle, spent 2 days making a cassoulet. He drove to Wellfleet one day, forcing himself not to take a book. He decided to ride out to Concord on his bike to see Emerson's house. On Saturday morning, he discovered that the chain needed to be fixed, and he brought the bike up to the deck. When he looked up, Sang was standing there, the phone in her hands, the cord stretched as far as it could go.
"Something weird just happened," she said.
"What?"
"It was that Deirdre woman, the one you took the message from when I was away."
Paul bent down, pretending to root around for something in his toolbox.
"She was asking for Farouk," Sang continued. "She says she's a friend of his visiting from out of town."
"Oh, so that must have been why she was calling," he said, relieved to hear that this was all Deirdre had said.
"He's never mentioned a Deirdre."
"Oh."
Sang sat down in a beach chair, the phone in her lap, her body leaning into it. She straightened, staring at the phone, pressing numbers at random without picking up the receiver.
"Farouk doesn't have any friends," she said. "Ever since I've known him, he's never introduced me to a single friend. I'm his only friend, really."
She looked intently at Paul, and for a second he feared she was about to draw some sort of parallel, point out that Paul didn't have friends either.
Instead, she said, "How did she get my number anyway?"
"She looked it up in Farouk's address book." Deirdre had confessed this to Paul. Farouk had made it easy for her, writing it under S for Sang, the name of the cousin he'd mentioned in a way that made her suspicious.
Paul shook his head, standing up, squeezing the handbrakes on the bicycle.
"Don't know. I guess I'd ask Farouk."
"Right. Ask Farouk."
She stood up and went back into the house. That evening, when Paul returned from Concord, he found Sang at the kitchen table. She said nothing as he went to the refrigerator to pull out the remains of the cassoulet.
"Farouk isn't in," she said, as if responding to a question on Paul's part. "He hasn't been in all day."
He lifted the lid of the baking dish and sprinkled a few drops of water on top of the cassoulet.
"You want some of this?"
"No, thanks."
She was frowning. Paul put the cassoulet in the oven and poured a scotch. The muscles in his arms and thighs ached pleasantly. He wanted to take a shower before eating.
"So, when exactly did this Deirdre person call?" Sang said, stopping him as he walked out of the kitchen.
He turned to face her, pivoting on his heels. "I don't remember. It was when you were away."
"And did she say anything to you?"
"What do you mean?"
"What did she say to you exactly?"
"Nothing. I didn't talk to her," he said, his pulse racing. He was thankful that he was already coated with sweat. "She just wanted you to call her back."
"Well, I can't call her back. She didn't even leave her number. It was weird. Did she sound like a weird sort of person to you?"
He remembered Deirdre's tears.
"I love him,"
she'd told Paul, a perfect stranger. He looked at Sang, manipulating his face into an uncomprehending expression.
"I'm not sure what you mean."
She sighed impatiently.
"Can you hand me that?"
she said, pointing to the message pad. Paul watched as Sang began flipping through the pages that had been turned over, running her finger down each line.
"What are you looking for?"
he said after a moment.
"Her number."
"Why?"
"I want to call her back."
"Why?"
She looked up at him exasperated.
"Because I want to, Paul. Is that a problem with you?"
He went upstairs to take his shower. It wasn't his business, he told himself as the hot water washed over him, and later, as he dried himself, then combed back his hair, enveloped in steam. When he came downstairs again, he found her on her hands and knees, going through the recycling bin,
newspapers and magazines piled around her.
"Damn it," she said.
"Now what are you looking for?"
"The number. I remember ripping out that page for some reason. I think I threw it away."
She began to put the newspapers and magazines back into the bin.
"Damn it,"
she said again. She stood up, kicking the bin lightly with her foot.
"I don't even remember her last name. Do you?"
He inhaled as if to seal the information inside himself, but then he shook his head, relieved at the opportunity at last to be honest with her. He too had forgotten Deirdre's last name. It was a name of one syllable, but apart from that detail, it had vanished from his brain.
"Hey, Paul," Sang said after a moment. "I'm sorry if I sounded harsh back then."
He walked across the kitchen, opened the oven. "Don't worry about it." Her stomach growled loudly enough for Paul to hear.
"God, I just realized I haven't eaten a thing today. I think I'll have some of that cassoulet after all. Should I make a salad?"
This would be their first dinner together alone, without Heather. He used to yearn for such an occasion. He used to feel clumsy and tongue-tied when Sang was in the room. Now he felt dread.
"I guess she was a little weird," he said slowly, gazing at the back of Sang's head, bent forward over the sink where she was ripping lettuce.
She turned around.
"How? How did she seem weird to you?"
He was so nervous that for a terrible instant, he worried that he might laugh out loud. Sang was regarding him steadily. The faucet was still running. She reached back to turn it off, and now the room was silent.
"She was crying," he said.
"Crying?"
Yeah.
"Crying how?"
"Just crying. Like, she was upset about something."
Sang opened her mouth as if to speak, but for a while it simply hung open.
"So let me get this straight. This woman Deirdre called and asked for me?"
Paul nodded.
"Right."
"And you said I wasn't there?"
"Right."
"And then she asked you to have me call her back?"
"Right."
"And then she started crying?"
"Yeah."
"And then what happened?"
"That was it. Then she hung up."
For a moment, Sang seemed satisfied with the information, nodding slowly. Then she shook her head abruptly as if to flick it away.
"Why didn't you tell me this?"
He regretted having offered her the cassoulet. He regretted ever having picked up the phone that day. He regretted that Sang and not another person had moved into the room, into his house, into his life.
"I did," he said calmly, drawing a line between them in his mind. "I told you she called."
"But you didn't tell me this."
"No."
She opened her eyes wide, incredulous.
"Didn't it occur to you I might want to know?"
He curled his lips together, looking away.
"Well,"
she demanded, shouting at him now, "didn't it?" When he still did not reply, she marched up to him, her hands clenched in fists, and he braced himself for a blow, twisting his face to one side. But she didn't strike him. Instead, she gripped the sides of her own head as if to steady herself.
"My God, Paul!"
Her voice was so shrill it was nearly inaudible.
"What the hell is wrong with you?"
Now it was she who began to avoid him. For a few nights, she was not at home. Paul saw her getting into Charles' truck with a weekend bag. Because Heather had by then all but officially moved in with Kevin, once again Paul found himself alone in the house. A week passed before he saw Sang again. Thinking himself alone, he hadn't bothered to shut his door. She came up to his room wearing a pretty dress he'd never seen, a white cotton short-sleeved dress fitted at the waist. The neck was square, showing off her collarbones.
"Hey,"
she said.
"Hey."
He had not missed her at all.
"Look, I just wanted to tell you that it's all a huge confusion. Deirdre is really an old friend of Farouk's from way back, from college."
"You don't have to explain it to me," Paul said.
"She lives in Canada," Sang continued, "in Vancouver."
"I see."
"They talk like once a year. Farouk mentioned my name to her years ago when we first got together, when he lived in another apartment, and she remembered it. She was trying to get in touch with him because she's getting married, and she wanted to send Farouk an invitation. She didn't have Farouk's new address or his number, and he's not listed. That's why she tried here."
She seemed strangely excited by her convoluted explanation. Some color had come to her cheeks.
There's only one thing, Paul.
He looked up. What's that?
Farouk called Deirdre to ask about what you said.
What I said?
About the crying?
Sang shrugged her shoulders, dropped them carelessly.
He told me she has no idea what you were talking about.
Her voice sounded compressed, the words running together quickly. Are you saying I made it up?
She was silent. For her sake, he'd told her about the crying. That night in the kitchen, watching her make the salad, he'd felt the walls collapsing around her. He'd wanted to warn her somehow. Now he wanted to push her from the doorframe where she stood.
Why would I make up a story like that?
He could feel a nerve on one side of his head throbbing. Instead of arguing with him, she gave a sympathetic glance, letting her head rest against the doorframe. I don't know, Paul.
It occurred to him that this was the first time she'd visited him in his room. For a moment, she appeared to be searching for a free place to sit. She straightened her head.
Did you really think it would make me leave him?
I didn't think it would make you do anything, Paul said. He was clenching his teeth now. His body felt heavy from her accusation. Numb. I didn't make it up.
I mean, it's one thing for you to like me, Paul, she continued. It's one thing for you to have a crush, but to make up a story like that?
She stopped, her mouth now straining into something that was not a smile.
It's pathetic, really. Pathetic.
And she walked out of the room. When they crossed paths again, she didn't apologize for the outburst. She didn't appear angry, only indifferent. He noticed that a copy of The Phoenix, which she'd left on top of the microwave, was folded to the real estate section, and that a few of the listings were circled. She came and went from Farouk's. She looked up at Paul briefly when she happened to see him with a mechanical little smile, and then she looked away as if he were invisible. The next time Sang worked at the bookstore, Paul stayed up in his room until he heard her leave the house. Once she was gone, he went to the kitchen, emptying out the recycling bin, which had not been taken out all winter. He flipped through each magazine, unfolded every newspaper, searching for the sheet of paper with Deirdre's number. It would be like Sang, he thought, to look for it and not find it. But Paul couldn't find it either. He pulled out the white pages and opened it at random, searching for a Deirdre, not caring how ridiculous he was being. Then he remembered it, her last name. It swam effortlessly back to his memory, accompanied by the sound of Deirdre's voice as she introduced herself to him that night on the telephone months ago. He turned to the F's, saw it there. A D. Frayne, an address in Belmont. He dragged the nail of his index finger beneath the listing, leaving a faint dent in the paper. He called the next day. He left a message on her machine asking her to call him back. He felt giddy having done it. In a way, it was his fear that Deirdre would not call him back, knowing that she too was now keeping her distance, that emboldened him to keep calling, to keep leaving messages. Deirdre, this is Paul. Please call me, he said each time. And then one day, she picked up the phone. I need to talk to you, he said. She recognized his voice.
I know. Listen, Paul,
he cut her off. It's not right, he said. He was sitting in a booth in the lobby of the library, watching as students flashed their ID cards to the security guard. He fished in his pocket for extra quarters. I listened to you. I was kind to you. I didn't have to talk to you.
I know, I'm sorry, it was wrong of me.
She no longer sounded drunk or flirtatious or desperate or upset in any way. She was perfectly ordinary, polite, but removed. I didn't even tell her the other stuff you told me. He saw that a student was standing outside the booth waiting for him to finish. Paul lowered his voice. He felt mildly hysterical. Remember all that stuff?
Look, please, I said I'm sorry. Can you hold on a second?
Paul heard a doorbell ring. After a minute, she came back to the phone.
I have to go now. I'll call you back.
When? Paul demanded, afraid that she was lying to him, that it was a ploy to be rid of him. In January, when Paul had wanted to get off the phone with Deirdre, she had pleaded with him to stay on the line.
Later, tonight, she said.
I want to know when.
She told him she'd call at 10.
The idea came to him immediately after getting off the phone, the receiver still in his hand.
He left the library, went to the nearest radio shack.
"I need a phone," he told the salesman, "and an adapter with two jacks."
It was a night Sang worked at the bookstore. As usual, she was home by 9. She said nothing to Paul when she came into the kitchen to get her mail.
"I called Deirdre," Paul said.
"Why don't you stop involving yourself this way?" Sang said evenly, leafing through a catalog.
"She's calling me at 10 o'clock, Paul said. "If you want, you can listen in without her knowing. I got another phone and hooked it up to our line."
She dropped the catalog, noticing the second phone.
"Jesus, Paul,"
she hissed.
"I can't fucking believe you."
She went into her room. At 9:55, she came out and sat next to Paul. He set the phones together on the table. At exactly 9:01, both phones rang. Paul picked up one.
"Hello?"
"It's me,"
Deirdre said. He nodded, motioning to Sang, and slowly, carefully, Sang picked up the other phone and put it to her ear without allowing it to touch her.
She held it unnaturally, the bottom of the receiver turned away from her mouth, pointed toward her shoulder. "Like I said, Paul, I'm sorry for calling you."
"I shouldn't have," Deirdre said. She seemed relaxed, willing to talk in no apparent rush. Paul relaxed a little too.
"But you did."
"Yes."
"And you cried about Farouk."
"Yes."
"And then you made me into a liar."
She was silent.
"You denied the whole thing."
"It was Freddy's idea."
"And you went along with it,"
Paul said. He was looking at Sang. She was pressing her top teeth into her lower lip in a way that looked painful.
"What was I supposed to do, Paul?"
Deirdre said.
"He was furious when he found out I'd called you. He refused to see me. He unplugged his phone. He wouldn't answer the door."
Sang put a palm against the table's edge as if to push it away, but she ended up pushing herself back in her chair, scraping the linoleum. Paul put a finger to his lips, but then he realized that to Deirdre, it was he who'd made the sound. She kept talking.
"Listen, Paul, I'm sorry you're in the middle of all this. I really am sorry I called. It was just that Freddy kept telling me Sang was his cousin, and when I asked him to introduce me to her, he refused. I didn't care at first. I figured I wasn't the only woman in his life, but then I fell in love with him."
She wanted to believe him, she explained. She was a 35-year-old woman, already married and divorced. She didn't have time for this.
"But I've ended it," she said matter-of-factly. "You know, there was a point when I actually believed he couldn't live without me. That's what he does to women. He depends on them. He asks them to do 100 things, makes them believe his life won't function without them. That was him this afternoon when you called, still wanting to see me, still wanting to keep me on the side. He doesn't have any friends, you see, only lovers. I think he needs them, the way other people need a family or friends."
She sounded reasonable and reflective now, as if she were describing an affair she'd had years before. Sang's eyes were closed, and she was shaking her head slowly from side to side. The dog was barking.
"That's my dog," Deirdre said. "He's always hated Freddy. He's the size of a football, but every time Freddy comes over, he makes me put a guardrail across the stairs."
Sang inhaled sharply. She put the receiver down quietly on the table. Then she picked it up again.
"I should go," Paul said.
"Me too," Deirdre agreed. "I think you need to tell her now."
He was startled, afraid Deirdre had discovered his trick, that she knew that Sang was listening in.
"Tell her what?"
"Tell her about me and Farouk. She deserves to know. It sounds like you're a good friend of hers."
Deirdre hung up. And for a long time, Paul and Sang sat there listening to the silence. He had cleared himself with Sang, and yet he felt no relief, no vindication. Eventually, Sang hung up her phone and stood up slowly, but made no further movements. She looked sealed off from things, holding herself as if she still needed to be perfectly stealthy, as if the slightest sound or gesture would betray her presence.
"I'm sorry," Paul said finally.
She nodded and went to her room, shutting the door. After a while, he followed her, stood outside.
"Sang, do you need anything?"
He remained there, waiting for her to reply. He heard her moving around the room.
When the door opened, he saw that she had changed into a black top with long, tight-fitting sleeves. Her pink raincoat was draped over her arm, her purse hanging over her shoulder. "I need a ride." In the car, she directed him, saying what to do and where to turn only at the last possible minute. They drove through Alston and down Storrow Drive. "There," she said, pointing. It was an ugly high-rise, bereft of charm and yet clearly exclusive, on the Cambridge side of the river. She got out of the car and started walking. Paul followed her. "What are you doing?" She speeded up. "I need to talk to him." She spoke in a monotone. "I don't know, Sang." She walked even faster, her shoes clicking on the pavement. The lobby was filled with beige sofas and potted trees. There was an African doorman sitting at the desk who smiled at them, recognizing Sang. He was listening to a radio tuned to the news in French.
"Evening, miss."
"Hello, Raymond."
"Getting cold again, miss. Maybe rain later."
"Maybe." She kept her finger pressed on the elevator button until it came, while she fixed her hair in the mirror opposite. On the 10th floor, they stopped, then walked to the end of the hallway. The doors were dark brown, thickly varnished. She tapped the door knocker, which was like a small brass picture frame hinged to the surface. Inside, there was the sound of a television. Then, there was silence. "It's me," she said. She tapped it again. 5 consecutive taps. 10. She pressed the top of her head against the door. "I heard her, Farouk. I heard Deirdre. She called Paul, and I heard her." Sang's voice was quavering. "Please open the door." She tried the knob, a strong metal knob which would not budge. There were footsteps, a chain being undone. Farouk opened the door, a dazed stubble on his face. He wore a flecked fisherman's sweater, corduroy pants, black espadrilles on bare feet. He looked nothing like a philanderer, just bookish and slight. "I did not invite you here," he said acidly when he saw Paul. In spite of all he knew, Paul was stung by the words, unable to speak in his own defense. "Please leave," Farouk said. "Please, for once, try to respect our privacy." "She asked me," Paul said. Farouk lurched forward, arms extended rigidly in front of him, pushing Paul away as if he were a large piece of furniture. Paul took a step back, then resisted, grabbing Farouk's wrists. The two men fell to the floor of the hallway, Paul's glasses flying onto the carpet. It was easy for Paul to pin Farouk to the ground, to dig his fingers into his shoulders. Paul squeezed them tightly through the thick wool of the sweater, feeling the give of the tendons, aware that Farouk was no longer resisting. For a moment, Paul lay on top of him fully, subduing him like a lover. He looked up, searching for Sang, but she was nowhere. He looked back at the man beneath him, a man he barely knew, a man he hated. "All she wants is for you to admit it," Paul said. "I think you owe her that." Farouk spat at Paul's face, a cold spray that made Paul recoil. Farouk pushed him off, went into his apartment, and slammed the door. Other doors along the hallway began to open. Paul could hear Farouk fastening the chain. He found his glasses and stood up, pressed his ear to the varnished wood. He heard crying, then a series of objects falling. At one point, he could hear Farouk saying, "Stop it, please, please, it's not as bad as you think." And then Sang saying, "How many times? How many times did you do it? Did you do it here on the bed?" A minute later, the elevator opened and a man walked toward Farouk's apartment. He was a lean man with gray hair and a big bunch of keys in his hand.
"I'm the super in this building. Who are you?" he asked Paul. "I live with the woman inside," he said, pointing at Farouk's door. "You her husband?" "No."
The super knocked on the door, saying neighbors had complained. He continued to knock, rapping the wood with his knuckles until the door opened. Inside was a hallway illuminated by track lights. Paul glimpsed a bright white kitchen without windows, a stack of cookbooks on the counter. To the right was a dining room painted the same sage green as Sang's room. Paul followed the super into the living room. There was an off-white sofa, a coffee table, a sliding glass door that led to a balcony. In the distance was a view of the Citgo sign, draining and filling with color. There was a bookcase along one wall which had fallen to the floor, its books in a heap. The receiver of a telephone on a side table hung from a cord, beeping faintly, repeatedly. In spite of these things, the room had a barren quality, as if someone were in the process of moving out of it. Sang was kneeling on an oriental carpet, picking up the pieces of what appeared to have been a clear glass vase. She was shivering. Her hair was undone, hanging toward the floor, partly shielding her face. There was water everywhere, and the ruins of a bouquet of flowers, irises and tiger lilies and daffodils. She worked carefully with the glass, creating a pile of shards on the coffee table. There were petals in her hair and stuck to her face and neck, and plastered to the skin exposed above her black scoop neck top, as if she had smeared them on herself like a cream. There were welts emerging above her neckline, fresh and bright. The men stood there looking at her, none of them saying anything. A policeman arrived, his black boots and his gun and his radio filling up the room, static from his radio replacing the silence. Someone in the building had called the station to complain, he said. He asked Sang, who was still on the floor, if Farouk had struck her. Sang shook her head. "Do you live here?" he asked. "I painted the walls," Sang said, as if that would explain everything. Paul remembered her painting her own room barefoot, listening to Billie Holiday. The policeman leaned over, inspecting the broken glass and flower debris on the carpet, noticing the welts on her skin. "What happened?"
"I bought them," she said, tears streaming quickly down her cheeks. Her voice was thick, ashamed. "I did this to myself."
After that, everything proceeded in an orderly way, with people moving in separate directions, not reacting to anyone else. The policeman filled out a form, then lent an arm and took Sang to the bathroom. The super left, saying something to Farouk about a fine. Farouk went to the kitchen, returning with a roll of paper towels and a garbage bag, and knelt by the carpet cleaning up the mess Sang had made. The policeman looked at Paul as if assessing him for the first time. He asked if Paul was an involved party.
"I'm her housemate," Paul replied. "I just gave her a ride."
The next morning, Paul was awakened by the noise of a car door closing. He went to the window and saw the trunk of a taxi being pressed down by the driver's hand. Sang had left a note on the kitchen table. She was going to London to visit her sister. "Paul, thanks for yesterday," it said. Along with this was a signed check for her portion of the rent. For a few days, nothing happened. He collected her mail. The bookstore called to ask where she was. Paul told them she had the flu. 2 weeks later, the bookstore called again. This time, it was to fire her. The third week, Farouk began to call, asking to speak to her. He didn't identify himself, didn't press Paul when he said night after night, "Sang's not in." He was polite to Paul in a way he had never been before, saying thank you, that he'd try later. Paul relished these calls. He liked depriving Farouk of the knowledge of where Sang was. But then, one day when he called, Heather, holed up in the house that week to study for an exam, happened to answer and said, "She's left the country," putting an end to Farouk's calls. At the end of the month, the rent was due. Paul and Heather didn't have enough to cover it. Instead of contacting Sang's parents, he looked up her sister's phone number in London on an old telephone bill. A woman answered who sounded just like her.
"Sang?"
The phone switched hands, and a man came on the line.
"Who is this?"
"This is her housemate in America, in Brookline. Paul. I'm trying to reach Sang." There was a long pause. After some minutes had passed, he wondered if he ought to hang up and try again. But then the man picked up the phone. He didn't apologize for the delay. "She's indisposed at the moment. I'm sure she'll appreciate your call." Charles came that weekend to pack up Sang's things. He tossed her clothes into garbage bags, stripped the futon of its sheets, and asked Paul to help him put it out on the sidewalk. Wrapping the framed Indian miniatures in newspaper at the kitchen table, he told Paul he'd talked to Sang on the phone, said that she'd be living in London with her sister through the summer.
"You know, I kept telling her to leave him. Can you believe I never even met the guy?"
Charles loaded up the back of his truck until all that was left of Sang in the house was the sage and mole paint on the walls of her room and the hanging plant over the dish drainer.
"I guess that's everything," Charles said.
The truck disappeared, but Paul stood a while longer looking at the houses lining the street. Though Charles was her friend, she had not told him. She had not told Charles that Paul had known for months about Deirdre. That night at Farouk's apartment, after washing up in the bathroom, Sang had got down on all fours and crawled into Farouk's coat closet, weeping uncontrollably, at one point hitting herself with a shoe. She'd refused to emerge from the closet until the policeman lifted her by the armpits and dragged her forcefully from the apartment, telling Paul to see her home. Tiny pieces of flower petals and leaves were still stuck in her hair. She had taken Paul's hand in the elevator and all the way back to the house. In the car, she had cried continuously with her head between her knees, not letting go of Paul's hand, gripping it even as he shifted gears. He had put the seatbelt on her. Her body had been stiff, unyielding. She seemed to know without looking up when they turned into their road. By then, she had stopped crying. Her nose was running. She wiped it with the back of her hand. A light rain had begun to fall, and within seconds the windows and the windshield seemed covered with scratches, similar to the ones she'd inflicted on herself, the drops beading up in small diagonal lines. The day Paul passed his exams, two of his professors took him to the Four Seasons bar for a drink. He had many drinks that afternoon. Ice-cold martinis on an unseasonably warm spring day. He drank them quickly on an empty stomach and little sleep the night before, and suddenly he was drunk. He had answered every question, passed with honors the three-hour ordeal. "Let's pretend it never happened," his committee told him, alluding to his previous embarrassment. After they left him shaking hands a final time, patting him on the back for good measure, he went to the men's room, splashed water on his face. He pressed a plush white towel to his temples, sprayed himself with some cologne from a leather-encased bottle by the sink. Returning to the lobby, the reception desk, the massive bouquets of flowers, the well-dressed guests, the brass carts piled with expensive luggage, all of them had spun around him like a carousel, then floated one by one in an arc across his vision. For a while, he stood watching these images appearing and fading like fireworks, not wanting them to end. He wanted money all of a sudden, enough of it to march up to the desk and request a room, a big white bed, silence. Outside, he turned a corner, crossed a street. He walked toward Commonwealth Avenue, so different at this end from the way it was by the university. Here, it was an elegant, tree-lined boulevard, flanked by spectacular homes and benches on which to sit and admire the architecture. The cross streets progressed alphabetically: Berkeley, Clarendon, Dartmouth. He walked slowly, still drunk, looking now and then for a taxi to take him home. At Exeter Street, he noticed a couple on a bench. It was Farouk and a woman, willowy but haggard. Her bony nose was a little too large for her face. Her slim legs were crossed. Her eyes, a limpid turquoise blue, were topped with mascara-coated lashes, and she blinked rapidly, as if irritated by a grain of sand. There was an empty bench across from them. Paul walked to it and sat down. Loosening his tie, he looked directly at Farouk. For this man, Deirdre had called a perfect stranger, made a fool of herself. For this man, Sang would rush from the house, had refused all her suitors. Because the suitors didn't know her, they hadn't had a chance. "It's not love," she used to say. They still called for her now and again, their voices eager, their intentions plain. "Do you know her number in London?" some asked, but Paul had thrown it away. His head tilting this way and that way, he studied Farouk carefully. Paul had lain on top of this man. He had felt those legs, that chest beneath his own, had smelled his skin and hair and breath. It was a knowledge he shared with Sang and Deirdre, a knowledge each had believed to be her own. Farouk and the woman exchanged glances. "Let them," Paul thought, smiling, a quiet snicker escaping him. There was nothing Farouk could do to stop him, not with this new woman at his side. He slouched down, his head against the wood of the bench now,
allowing the afternoon sun to warm his body, his face. He was tempted to stretch out. He closed his eyes. He felt a poke in the side of his arm. It was Farouk standing in front of him. "You should be grateful I didn't sue," Farouk said. He spoke precisely, yet without rancor, as if he were making casual conversation. Paul rubbed his eyes behind his glasses, displacing them.
"What?"
"You've damaged my shoulder. I had to get an MRI. I may need surgery." The woman, now standing a few feet behind Farouk, said something Paul was unable to hear.
"He should know,"
Farouk said to the woman, his voice rising unpleasantly. Then he shrugged, and they walked off together. There was something curious about the way they were walking, together and yet with a space between them. It was only then that Paul noticed a small yellow dog at the end of a very long leash, stretched taut in the woman's hand, pulling her along the path.
Part 2. Hema and Kaushik. Once in a lifetime. I had seen you before, too many times to count, but a farewell that my family threw for yours at our house in Inman Square is where I began to recall your presence in my life. Your parents had decided to leave Cambridge, not for Atlanta or Arizona, as some other Bengalis had, but to move all the way back to India, abandoning the struggle that my parents and their friends had embarked upon. It was 1974. I was 6 years old. You were 9. What I remember most clearly are the hours before the party, which my mother spent preparing for everyone to arrive. The furniture was polished, the paper plates and napkins set out on the table, the rooms filled with the smell of lamb curry and pulao, and the l'air du temps my mother used for special occasions, spraying it first on herself, then on me, a firm squirt that temporarily darkened whatever I was wearing. I was dressed that evening in an outfit that my grandmother had sent from Calcutta. White pajamas with tapered legs, and a waist wide enough to gird two of me side by side, a turquoise kurta, and a black velvet vest embroidered with plastic pearls. The three pieces had been arrayed on my parents' bed while I was in the bath, and I stood shivering, my fingertips puckered and white, as my mother threaded a length of thick drawstring through the giant waist of the pajamas with a safety pin, gathering up the stiff material bit by bit, and then knotting the drawstring tightly at my stomach. The inseam of the pajamas was stamped with purple letters within a circle, the seal of the textile company. I remember fretting about this fact, wanting to wear something else, but my mother assured me that the seal would come out in the wash, adding that because of the length of the kurta, no one would notice it anyway. My mother had more pressing concerns. In addition to the quality and quantity of food, she was worried about the weather. Snow was predicted for later that evening, and this was a time when my parents and their friends didn't own cars. Most of the guests, including you, lived less than a 15-minute walk away, either in the neighborhoods behind Harvard and MIT, or just across the Mass Avenue Bridge. But some were coming farther, coming by bus or the T from Malden or Medford or Waltham. "I suppose Dr. Chowdhury can drive people home," she said of your father as she untangled my hair. Your parents were slightly older, seasoned immigrants, as mine were not. They had left India in 1962 before the laws welcoming foreign students changed. While my father and the other men were still taking exams, your father already had a PhD, and he drove a car, a silver Saab with bucket seats, to his job at an engineering firm in Andover. I had been driven home in that car many nights, after parties had gone late and I had fallen asleep in some strange bed or other. Our mothers met when mine was pregnant. She didn't know it yet. She was feeling dizzy and sat down on a bench in a small park. Your mother was perched on a swing, gently swaying back and forth as you soared above her, when she noticed a young Bengali woman in a sari, wearing vermilion in her hair. "Are you feeling all right?" your mother asked in the polite form. She told you to get off the swing, and then she and you escorted my mother home. It was during that walk that your mother suggested that perhaps mine was expecting. They became instant friends, spending their days together while our fathers were at work. They talked about their lives they had left behind in Calcutta, your mother's beautiful home in Jodhpur Park, with hibiscus and rose bushes blooming on the rooftop, and my mother's modest flat in Maniktala, above a grimy Punjabi restaurant where 7 people existed in 3 small rooms. In Calcutta, they would probably have had little occasion to meet, Your mother went to a convent school and was the daughter of one of Calcutta's most prominent lawyers, a pipe-smoking Anglophile, and a member of the Saturday Club. My mother's father was a clerk in the General Post Office, and she had neither eaten at a table nor sat on a commode before coming to America. Those differences were irrelevant in Cambridge, where they were both equally alone. Here, they shopped together for groceries and complained about their husbands and cooked at either our stove or yours, dividing up the dishes for our respective families when they were done. They knitted together, switching projects when one of them got bored. When I was born, your parents were the only friends to visit the hospital. I was fed in your old high chair, pushed along the streets in your old pram. During the party, it started snowing, as predicted, stragglers arriving with wet, white cape coats that we had to hang from the shower curtain rod. For years, my mother talked about how, when the party ended, your father made countless trips to drive people home, taking one couple as far as Braintree, claiming that it was no trouble, that this was his last opportunity to drive the car. In the days before you left, your parents came by again to bring over pots and pans, small appliances, blankets and sheets, half-used bags of flour and sugar, bottles of shampoo. We continued to refer to these things as your mother's. "Get me Parul's frying pan," my mother would say, or, "I think we need to turn the setting down on Parul's toaster." Your mother also brought over shopping bags filled with clothes she thought I might be able to use that once belonged to you. My mother put the bags away and took them with us when we moved, a few years later, from Inman Square to a house in Sharon, incorporating the clothes into my wardrobe as I grew into them. Mainly they were winter items, things you would no longer need in India. There were thick t-shirts and turtlenecks in navy and brown. I found these clothes ugly and tried to avoid them, but my mother refused to replace them, and so I was forced to wear your sweaters, your rubber boots on rainy days. One winter I had to wear your coat, which I hated so much that it caused me to hate you as a result. It was blue-black with an orange lining and a scratchy grayish-brown trim around the hood. I never got used to having to hook the zipper on the right side, to looking so different from the other girls in my class with their puffy pink and purple jackets. When I asked my parents if I could have a new coat, they said no. A coat was a coat, they said. I wished that one of the boys in my class, many of whom owned identical coats, would accidentally pick it up in the narrow alcove where we rushed to put on our things at the end of the day. But my mother had gone so far as to iron a label inside the coat with my name on it, an idea she'd got from her subscription to Good Housekeeping. Once I left it on the school bus. It was a mild, late winter day, the windows on the bus open, everybody's outerwear shed on the seats. I was taking a different bus than usual, one that dropped me off in the neighborhood of my piano teacher, Mrs. Hennessy. When the bus neared my stop, I stood up, and when I reached the front,